All right, good morning, Winter Park. Welcome to Punkonomics here at WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. Of course, if you're looking at your dial, it should say 91.5. Anyway, just like every other week, we sit here and we talk about certain issues that most of the media doesn't talk about. But anyway, with no further ado, Dr. Benny Balick.
Hello, morning.
I don't think they heard you.
Hello, good morning. We have a special guest today. It's David Burns, maybe.
Mike Burns. Close enough.
Oh, dear.
I don't know where I got...
Oh, of course where, because I'm from the Talking Heads where I got it. I was
that's right.
When I saw your name, I was like, oh, that's just like one of my favorite artists. So it's Mike, or Michael, actually, if you look for him on Amazon. And I did post somewhere that link for you to check him out, because he's an author, a non-fiction author, a fiction author. I'm a non-fiction author. And pretty soon I better shut up or get another coffee. But we got a lot of questions. We've already burned through the last half hour discussing the world and everything. But before we get sidetracked that way, I wanted also to ask, you're local, where, what? Give us the info about yourself that you want to. You don't have to what you don't want to.
My bio's, I'll give you the basic bio. I mean, I grew up in New Jersey, you know, and I lived there all the way up until just about 6 years ago, moved to Florida. Seeking, to pursue my writing career and give the family a better life and some sunshine and some vitamin D and all that fun stuff. So, love Florida, settled in now. And so I'm a Jersey boy by trade. I went to
Of the schooling system or healthcare or anything like that.
Well,
bother you?
Wondering. No, we have great. I'm lucky. I'm in a community with great schools. Thank God. But. I have went to get my undergrad is in business at Montclair State University in New Jersey, so I didn't make it too far there from home. But and then I got my MBA at Rutgers, and cut my teeth in the insurance business. That was my day job, and still is. I've been in the business for over 20 years at this point. Oh, just about 20 years. 93 I started during one of the last great recessions, which was nothing compared to what we were dealing with today. But so that's kind of where I'm at, and I've always had writing as I was always interested in writing, writing recreationally and as a hobby, and in English classes, things like that. Of course, like everybody else, but my professors always told me to pursue it, that I was decent at it, and I was really not as decent as I thought that I was at the time. It takes a long time to get the chops down right, but I experimented with writing back in. 2002 maybe I started really considering it again after I got done with all my grad school work and didn't have to read for work, quote unquote, and I got time to pursue it. So that's kind of where it all started off. So I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, well, that's before I keep grilling you, and then we just, we chat as we usually do. We do have also a special guest, maybe he'll reveal himself, or maybe he's not. It's my son. I mean, all my family's been on our radio shows until now. The last stalwart, that's right, the term, my boy Felix. And he's also, he's writing, he's working on it. You see, it takes time, so don't
be
discouraged.
It takes a long time, that's right.
I'm not being discouraged. Yeah. You just keep saying that I'm absolutely the most phenomenal writer in the entire world.
I think you have a lot of potential. I really do.
Yeah,
I'm not just saying it.
Yeah, and writing's if you're a fan of Malcolm Gladwell, I don't know if you've read any of his books, Outliers and Tipping Point and all that stuff.
I'm not sure, actually.
So he basically says, and I repeat myself with this all the time, and I believe him 100% on it, is that it takes 10,000 hours to pretty much be an expert at anything. So you can be... You don't have to have superior abilities necessarily, but you have to have the passion to finish that 10,000 hours.
3 years? No.
More than that. Probably four, five years, most folks, if you're pursuing something full-time. And then, like anything else, when you get good at something or, you keep going, just like, when you're a university professor, that extra 15 minutes a day from that point forward keeps you pretty much on the track of being an expert, and you can keep up on it. But getting your chops down takes, takes quite a long time, and it's a commitment.
Because I write nonfiction as part of the job of being an academic, and I'm kind of proud. It's not my native tongue. I don't really have a native tongue. So I'm proud of writing in English and writing decent, so they say, and all that. But when you write fiction, is it also the case where your editor basically rips the manuscript out of your the unfinished manuscript out of your hand and says, yeah, it's done, it's getting published, now go away. Yeah, it's not ready, it's not ready, I need another 10 years.
You know? It is such a process. You know, it's... I think for the author or her writer of anything, fiction, nonfiction, you know, you'll probably never be 100% satisfied, and you'll always be embarrassed when you go back and read it once it's in print, and you'll say, "Oh, I can't believe I made that mistake," or this inconsistency, or whatever else. Or maybe you fall flat in certain areas of the story that when you look back on. But when you work, you can't work in a vacuum either with creativity. That's at least my feeling, and I'm very much a fan of being critiqued and I would say criticized, but it's more critiqued. You know what? You know, criticism is somebody saying whether they like something or not, maybe without a foundation in the actual art itself. So I look for folks that, you know, if you want to improve your craft, look for people that don't praise you, look for people that know what they're doing and understand the art or the craft or the sport or anything else, and take their advice, because that's how you improve. Nobody's natural. I don't believe, I mean, you can have the natural gift or a knack for doing something, but you're not going to go to the next level unless you really broaden your horizons.
We have a little statue a few paces away from here on campus where it's Benjamin Franklin sitting around in bronze on some bench, but what it quotes him as saying, what genius genius without education is like gold down the mine or silver down the mine.
Right.
It's there, but you can't really apply it. So apparently Benjamin Franklin said that. So yeah, it's a little bit similar. And it's hard also because you're at awe. I mean, if you're reading, my favorite author is maybe Ursula K. Le Guin, basically, you know, I think. I'm a big, big, big sci-fi fan, and I read new post-cyberpunk too, but Le Guin, to me, she every time blows my mind. So when you read that stuff and then you have to sit down, I'm at awe before you guys, you know, and then I have to sit down in front of that white screen and come up with something that you don't immediately chuck out because it's just not that good. Yeah. But she is 97 or something and maybe the best sci-fi writer of all times and maybe one of the important writers of the 20th century. So come on.
Yeah. And writing is, you know, it's one of those things where that's the questions you get the most when you're published or anything else, which, you know, it's just a lot. Some of it's luck and timing and, you know, but a lot of writing or anything else is just execution, you know, and most folks have a problem conceptualizing execution because they have great story. I mean, I can't tell you how many folks I've talked to that say, I have a great idea for a book. Well, the idea, you know, ideas are...
Small part.
Oh, yeah, very small. Ideas are the smallest piece of the equation.
Right.
So, and execution is not about inspiration per se. I mean, inspiration is the story idea where you're like, you get that aha moment. You're like, wow, yeah, that's a great concept. I can build a story around it this way or that way. And you have a loose structure in your brain. But the fundamental work that needs to get done from that point forward, it's really discipline, structure. It's a job. It's a lonely job, too, because you're doing it by yourself. There's nobody there guiding you along the way, telling you how to write a sentence. I mean, but you do have editors, you know, when you get to, you know, the more formalized stage of the process where you have a raw manuscript that needs to then be polished and scrubbed. You have, you know, folks that really know the craft that are checking your grammar, checking your consistency, checking the story flows.
If you have a real contract. I mean, again,
if you have a real contract, and that's it. Yeah, that's hard.
It depends. Yeah, I was fortunate enough to publish my book with a major with Routledge, and I had a professional editor that even suggested places where my argument was somewhat ambiguous, saying, oh, the reader might misinterpret, and she just saved my Heinz part in a couple of places, and I told her so again and again, and even sent her flowers. But my wife's book, she being in the humanities, she had nothing. She had to do it. Run it by me, run it by other people, and try and get all the errors out. That was just not part of the package.
Yeah, and it's tough, and that's the hard part. Is operating, like I said, operating in a vacuum is not a really good way to pursue it. I think that, you know, it's nice to be around other writers if they're available to you. Get criticism or critiques, I should say, when you can get them. Classes and all that's fine, you know, I would think. But if you have a natural interest in the craft, you can kind of hone it on your own. I don't know that you have to go through. Yeah, I don't think you have to. I think it's more time spent and reading. You have to read a lot. It's like anything else. I mean, you know, if you want to play basketball or anything else, you got to kind of know your sport, watch the game, look at the folks that are really excelling
at
it, and the players that really, you know, take it to the next level. And then you can learn from them. And then, you know, obviously you got to get out on the court yourself and bounce the ball and take the shots and, you know, put the time in. So I think a lot of it for somebody who's really passionate doesn't need to waste, and I hate, and I could probably be hung up for saying this by the literary crowd, but, you know, I mean, you need the basic building blocks of grammar, story, structure, all these things. But you got to just do it. Most people just don't do it. And the other thing too is if you're copying all the greats, or you're you know, if you're writing the same old stuff everybody else is writing, just in a different collage, it's probably not going to get heard. So that unique voice that comes out of doing your own thing is probably your best gift. You know, I mean, at least that's how I look at it.
Yeah, so you're also talking about something that's very close to my heart, this need of being educated.
Yeah, oh, that's,
so
you
I
need
pointed
it.
Out to
you
a
need,
lot of people,
oh, yeah, yeah.
You don't, even if you don't, I point out to students, because education is an act of seduction, really. I mean, sadly,
sure.
Too many professors don't understand that, by the way. That's a very key insight that everybody has to understand. You don't, like the old, I think, Talmudic Hebrew saying that how you teach the Bible by beating you with the book. That's actually how it translates.
That's
literally.
Good. That's good.
That I'll beat the Bible into you means I will teach you, you know, religious, traditional Jewish religious studies. That's how it translates.
Yeah.
No, it's seduction. So in many ways, you know, I'll show, you know, check out the South Park episode. You think it's really cool. It is, you know, I keep plugging them. It's the highest form of serious cultural criticism. The only other place in America you'll hear about these things are in, you know, radical sociology journals and South Park, you know?
Yeah.
So people don't realize, why is it so, check out these guys, they seem goofy and everything, but if you look carefully at the show, you realize they are well-read. They've watched all the classical movies because they make all these allusions. And if you haven't read or watched all that you don't get the jokes.
Exactly. Yeah,
you're not getting the jokes.
That reminds me of like watching cartoons as a kid, you know, Bugs Bunny and all that. I mean, there was so much satire and adult humor and built into those, you know, even the earliest cartoons and all that.
So yeah, I think it seems like, you know, those who
that
do
inspires
good
art. You. Yeah, those ideas inspire you, even if you're making cartoons or anything, or songs or whatever, you know. So I agree with you. I think education is hugely important, no matter what, you know, no matter what avenue you choose to pursue with it, creatively or otherwise.
And that's liberal education in a sense. Again, it's not some kind of, oh, will it get you a job? To watch I don't know, I'm thinking of South Park, so what to watch Miyazaki's epic My Neighbor Totoro and realize and Lovecraft's 19th century horror novels to understand the episode on the BP oil spill. I guess only like serious South Parkers who followed through
with
me, but yeah, they referenced the movie, they shot to shot, you know, literally, and they did it for Clockwork Orange remarkably, by the way, like shot to shot exactly.
I haven't seen that
Stanley
one.
Kubrick. It's a brilliant bit, and if you understand the original movie, then immediately the episode takes a whole new dimension that it didn't before, because it brings all that in. But in a sense, you know, this is not some kind of world skill. I mean, to do the animation in case of South Park doesn't take too hard. Eventually, like you say, work at it, and after 10,000 hours, you might be good at it.
Yeah.
But
and you can compress that time in Hollywood or other places because you have teams working for you at that point. So
well,
that always helps, right?
Successful.
I mean,
right.
Sure, you can kind of spread that time
but
out.
But will you be able to even write an episode like that? Haven't you not seen this classic Stanley Kubrick and read the 19th century? This, the kind of, oh, that fluffy stuff, why do we bother our kids with this sort of thing? Can't we teach them something that will get them a job? Well, frankly, that's hubris, as the Greeks say. That's unjustified pride. Do you know what jobs will be available
three years
from now?
Correct.
If anybody tells you,
that's the problem with the workforce, and you see in the legal profession and plenty of other professions, like you said, like the MBA being obsolete.
Lawyers,
good money well spent for me, I guess. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's always looking at the current trend that, and it's, you know, what's interesting too, I can make the parallel to publishing itself, because when you're writing books, from concept to, you know, to formally getting your, say, final manuscript done through editing and all that, I mean, you could be, and then having go through the process of the marketing and getting it placed in stores, you're always 2 to 3 years behind.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how long the process, I mean, you're not writing that whole time, it's going through the editing process for a big chunk of it and back and forth, and you're a lot of waiting in between and, you know, whatever else. But by the time the book hits the shelf, it's not like I'm going to go out and write a vampire book, let's put it that way. So you got to be careful chasing trends. I mean, that's why you got to stay true, I guess, to what you really enjoy.
Not vampires again.
Please, God,
my kids have traumatized me with this like visceral anti-Twilight culture.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, hey, for folks that are interested, you know, readers that like that's, I mean, I hate, who am I to, you know, everybody has their preferences.
There's a context issue, though, to some extent. I mean, we can judge aesthetically, right? Art. I mean, you know, I found it, let's not go too, I mean, I did watch about 10 minutes and I couldn't take much more. not because of anything insulting or just boring.
Yeah.
It's a vampire movie. It has to have violence and sex.
Yeah, I guess
mean, it's vampires.
Sure.
It's about repressed sexuality in the 19th century. That's what it's about. I mean, how can you... Like, there's what, that rice... Like,
and rice.
The 80s were very fashionable.
Sure,
I remember
right.
Last
thought.
Yeah, it's bestsellers. It's not like epic literature, fine, but it's okay. It's a good job.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that too, because in the work of fiction, I mean, there's such a broad brush that you can paint it with there. But I mean, guys like me, I'm not a literary buff. I mean, I don't read the classics all day long, and you know, hope that I'm creating the next, you know, great American novel. It doesn't work like. My job is to entertain people, right? I mean, it's escapism.
It's all your business, in fact. It's not for
and
you
it's
to
my
decide
therapy.
If it's the great American novel.
Yeah,
right?
And a writer's a writer's work, much like a musician's music or anything else, it's our escape. It's our therapy.
Yeah,
you know. So if I have frustrations or. You know, these things that go on in my brain. I mean, it's the one place that you can really explore them.
Right.
And you know, put even if you have these views that you don't even necessarily think in your own brain or things you agree with, but you think of them as possible, you know, realities or the alter ego to what you are. Or, you know, you can put them in, you can embody them in characters, and you can kind of play them out in these fake, you know, scenarios, and nobody gets hurt, and you know, and you can explore it, and you know, hopefully along the way get, you know, be thought provoking at some level, maybe not intentionally, but. You know, and that's what I love about writing is that it does. It provides you a complete, you know, a blank slate where you can just, or blank canvas where you can just fling paint and hopefully make something that looks coherent come out at the end. But so, and it's funny because with education, it all feeds together though, because the reason I wrote my first book, The Sacred Bones, that was, that was shortly after 9/11. I was very interested in Islam and, you know, the Palestinian conflict and all these
things. Because I'm eager. I got to say that in always honest here, right? Always
honesty.
Yeah, yeah. I have yet to read the guy's book, and here he's on my show by recommendation of my wife, trust.
Yeah.
Though, you know, she comes to the house and says, I met this guy, and he's just like you. I'm like, whoa.
just for the record, I'm not sure I'm going to...
Yeah. Should I be... Is it a compliment? Should I be jealous? What's that?
We look a lot alike, though. It's...
but I will, because it's very intriguing just from the descriptions, right? I mean, you'd call it, it's kind of sci-fi broadly in the sense that it deals with society and in a somewhat not...
Yeah.
Right?
Well, it's got a little bit of everything. I mean, it's I try to keep it in the realm of believability, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I it's interesting because the story I had in mind when I wrote that, or at least the concept, that aha moment, like I was saying before, is, okay, what would happen if in the modern day... The Vatican hired a mercenary team to go in and extract a relic from beneath the Temple Mount, and then it sets off a firestorm between Israelis and Palestinians, and then nobody could even see the true
criminal.
Happen. Right, and the other thing too is really it would probably start World War III, right? I mean, any violation of the Temple Mount, if you're familiar with the site at all, is, you know, would certainly spark.
I really have to read your book to erase from my head this. Image of that Vatican squad just comes chum Monty Python in my
head.
Oh,
know? Well done. Yeah, and this is funny.
It's the Spanish Inquisition, right?
Yes.
But that's how a somewhat absurd idea, right? It almost sounds absurd, but if you write it properly and you present it properly and the motives are clear and, you know, throughout the story, then it becomes believable, you know, to the point where you know, people get scared and it provokes their thoughts. But, you know, in order for me to write that story, I had to learn a lot because, you know, you never go into a story. I mean, you know, you hear guys
like
Steve.
Shouldn't. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you hear a lot of authors always saying you should be familiar with, you know, write about what you know. Well, that's not real interesting to me because nobody really cares about selling insurance or, you know, the things I do during the day. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, if you have that idea and you think, you know, whether it sounds absurd or not, if you can build a good story around it, that becomes mechanical and there's tools you can use and you create structure and then you start going through the discipline of writing and you see how the story goes. And if, you know, and you may not have a clear picture about the end of it, of where it's, you know, what the ending may look like, and you can start writing. Now, I mean, nowadays I write more structured because it's just easier because it's such a big job. So, I do synopsis and I do outlines and create skeletons. You know, format the book.
So you're not kind of just let the story grab.
The kind of stories I write are not, you know, free flow. You know, there's usually multiple plots going on. Subplots. You know, building. You know, all interweaving together. And there's all sorts of different things going on. And I think to keep track of it in my brain, I need some type of structure ahead of time.
Okay.
You know, I mean, some people, you know, the Stephen Kings of the world, I'll mention him again. I know he's a big advocate of just write. Mm. Sit down and write. You don't need to know where it's all going. And that's okay. I mean, but I think that...
Though, in all honesty, and, you know, and I enjoyed
that's more linear writing style.
Exactly. It's a very simple writing,
it's
Stephen.
A goes to B, goes to C, goes to D. You know,
like I prefer by far Philip K. Dick, you know, but talk about like bam in your face, but and short and all that. So yeah, okay, different styles. I'm motivated here myself again because of Felix. You know, that I see his method. It's just interesting. I never could write fiction, and I'm always, you know.
When did you try?
As a kid, and kind of abandoned it. You know, I wonder why, but you know.
Well, then just. Try. You can't just say, "Oh, I'm not good at it," and decide.
You have to
not.
Sleep too a few hours a day. You
know?
But hey,
that's
you
never
know,
enough time.
One day. No, I know. Not. Once you start getting published, and you know, and mommy writes her sex and drugs and fairy tales book, and it goes on Oprah. Is Oprah still?
Oh, yeah, Oprah still around.
And we retire. Then I will be I'll be your editor, and maybe we can co-author something. By then you'll be well established.
And I'd say, you know, for anybody young who's looking to write like Felix, I mean, you know, writing is a very difficult, you know, keep your day job is the one thing I would say.
Surely.
Always keep your day job. I mean, you know, the beauty of what I like about hobbies that turn into professions that turn into money and all these things is that you don't have to give up the rest of your life. You know, a lot of people think you have to go lock yourself in a cabin somewhere, not talk to your family for 6 months and go get inspired, and you know, then it'll come to you as an epiphany, you know, like Muhammad with the Quran or something, you know what I mean? Or Joseph Smith.
I write sci-fi. I can't go into a cabin and like find myself in a spaceship and draw inspiration from that. Like, idyllic surroundings might be helpful and might clear your brain or something, but I don't know. For me, I'm much more comfortable in front of my computer.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny, when I come up with my stories, I usually have just the old notepad and pen just to kind of, I let the let the ideas flow as freely as possible initially, get it down. All your initial thoughts. You might know the ending before you know the beginning. You might know this. So like the initial, you know, concepts of books, you keep that notepad around or whatever, and you just kind of jot it down wherever you are. And I've been fortunate enough that I don't have any specific routines about writing. You get that question a lot, you know, like, how do you write? What's the craft? You know, is it, do you go to a certain place and, you know, do I roll the dice and do I, you know, turn this three ways clockwise, you know, three turns clockwise, all the little fetishes and the, you know, and for me, I'm lucky that I'm not that anal, right. at least with writing. I mean, I'm sure people that know me would argue I'm anal in plenty of other categories, but you know, I mean, I've been flexible enough that I'll write in Starbucks, I'll write at the library, I'll write at the pond, I'll write at, you know, I'll write with my kids screaming in the background. If the idea, you know, and I almost find that the craziness of life drives my creativity, and I actually need other things going on to actually pull those thoughts out of the deep recesses of my brain. It's almost like the chaos adds to the creativity. For me, I mean, some people say they really need to go lock themselves away and try and, but like I said, there's aha moments with writing. It's not, you cannot, in my mind, sit there and try and beat an idea out of your brain, you know? I mean, but that's where, like we said before, where, you know, education and reading and all these other things, exposing yourself to material can certainly help you. Because, you know, I mean, if you look at a scenario or conspiracy or a historical event or something, you'd be like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if that guy did this and then this happened? Mm. You know, so the aha moments can come through, you know, exposure to all these things, which is great. But I don't think you have to do it in solitude, personally. Mm. That's just me.
Right, I suppose it depends on the kind of, you know, writing.
I don't like my little sister running around and, like, asking me for help with whatever every 5 minutes, sure, but I don't like to just lock myself up either.
Yeah, And, you know, and so I guess some folks, you know, I mean, some writers, I'm sure plenty, and again, like I said, I write more for entertainment. My style of writing is more to entertain. It's more, you know, it'll probably read more like, you know, you can visualize it more like a movie than you would a, you know, some character sketch of, you know, seeing how, you know, a character, you know, fights his demons, right? I mean, so I like, you know, my story, I like to think of it as the story really pulling people along and keeping the interest and things like that. And then the characters are kind of coming along for the ride. And, you know, so I'm probably less character driven than some authors. And everybody has a different style. But see, that's what I love about writing is there is no right way to do it. As long as you're entertaining it, you know, entertain your reader, and they want to keep turning the pages and hopefully buy your next book or whatever else, you know, that's great.
Now, do you find that it's a lot easier to write than to actually go through the process of finding a publisher? I mean,
well,
how much
nowadays,
time do you dedicate on either side?
You don't need one nowadays.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you what, though, and this is good information for Felix or anybody else looking to get their work out there. Once you have it to a point where you're comfortable and you've had enough people kind of give it a look, you know, give the critique, not criticize, but give a good critique, somebody who knows what they're doing, helps you to fine tune it and you know, make the manuscript the best it can be, or your whatever screenplay or anything else. There's a website I used back when I first started marketing called publishersandagents.com. Publishers, word and, will take your synopsis, which is your, you know, obviously your sales pitch, watered down. Yeah, your, you know,
summary of the book.
Yeah, yeah, it's your pitch letter, your pitch version of the book or whatever. And they'll send the query out to all the publishers and agents that fit your automated, so that you don't have to wait around, you know, and hope that something's going to happen. And it works. It really works.
Yeah, it's interesting because you can be independent today and just publish it yourself, but
sure.
But then you don't have benefit of precisely the critiques you're talking about, of professionals, editors.
Yeah, yeah.
To give you feedback as well as to promote potentially, etc.
Yeah. Felix just pulled the website up. It's not the most impressive looking website, but functionally on the back end, it does all the things it needs to do.
And that reminds me of the fetishism that we mentioned. I mean, you know, as a real old time and geek and a cultural snob. But in a funny way, I'm a cultural snob, you know.
Now, yeah, come on.
I'm a cultural snob, but kind of in a funny way, usually. You know, that's you know, like dressed like a bum because I'm that snob, you know. I never wear a suit for that unless I have to feed my family. What was I saying? Yes, you know, so the term is coined by another all-time favorite sci-fi author, Neal Stephenson. I believe it's his, the techno-fetishism. So in some sense, you know, the old school geeks, you know, that have been on the internet since the 80s and all that stuff and played video games on mainframes in the 70s and blah, blah, blah. We find that now the technology is, everybody's got technology. Everybody has a computer in their pocket.
Talk about ubiquitous.
They're such newbies. I mean, you know, they're so attached to their, it's techno-fetishism. So when you were talking about, right, using a paper and pen or pencil, absolutely. There are things that just cannot be mimicked. And in fact, today, in a digital age, analog is chic.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, right?
Everybody's
right.
Showing their gadgetry,
out,
you know? It's pageantry, really. It's like the traditional peoples, you know, what there was cargo fetishism in New Guinea. Where they'd have a can of tuna, you know, made into a headdress because it was such an exotic thing, a can of tuna.
Right.
Used already, you know, some British colonialists en route. But it's a little bit like that, I find, this material culture fetishism.
Yeah.
I mean, so I'm being...
Well, I don't want to downplay technology either, because technology, I mean, look, the books, the kind of stories I write wouldn't be possible maybe 10, 15 years ago without the internet and other tools where I can...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, think about, like, you know, like, as a writer, Felix, I mean, think about Google Earth and things like that, where you can actually, instead of having to physically go to someplace and measure out distances, and, I mean, you can get an aerial shot and kind of go down to street view and look at the settings and you know, so it gives you, you know, I think there's so many great tools out there for writers now that you can pull from that save you so much time and research. But
that's not fetishism. That's
wonderful
tools. And I love technology on so many levels. It's the fetishism that becomes, in the sense of making it not what you can do with the machine, but the actual ritualistic use of it. Oh, look at me. I'm on my computer. I have the latest shiny tablet.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how to use it. But it shines.
Yeah, I'm glad I don't have to tap out my stories on a typewriter. Let's put it that way. I mean, I'm glad there's certain things that are that I'm willing to embrace certain fetishes for the
course.
You know, it's funny because I type faster than I can speak, so or write. So when I get down to the you know, the craft of writing, I mean, you know, to the mechanical pieces of just sitting there and typing out dialogue and I mean, you know, it's I love working on the computer, you know, because it's just so easy. It flows perfectly, you know, because I can't do that with if it was writing or typing. So I mean, it's funny. I wonder if I'd ever have been a writer in a previous, you know, decades ago.
Oh, I still remember, you know, definitely, you know, undergrad. Early undergrad.
I've got a question though. How do you do dialogue? I always find it like, I know what's going to happen, so I don't know what the characters would say to find it out, you know?
Well, it's, that's a good question, Felix. It's a fantastic question. No, the only way you get dialogue down is be a conversationalist, talk to people, and talk to a lot of different people, because really, you know, it's just like if I was writing a dialogue for a radio show like this, I can imagine, you know, once we know each other and we understand the dynamic, you know, I can imagine how you'd respond, how I'd respond, the type of words you use, the inflection, the pauses, you know, and dialogue in fiction is kind of a little strange because it's never really true to life. Because you see how many times when I just said this sentence, how many times I've paused and the nod and, you know, you don't write that into the story. It usually flows pretty cleanly, or, you know, and every now and then a character will interject or cut one another off, and you'll see dashes where, you know, the sentence is abruptly cut off. But if you look at, for the most part, dialogue is still proper grammar. It may have some colloquialisms in there that you know, how people speak, you know, maybe they're regionally or a dialect or of slang. You know, those are great tools you can use. But the reality is you got to imagine yourself in a real conversation with real people. How would they talk? And what are they talking about? You don't want them talking about random, random topics that don't pertain to the story. So the tough part of dialogue is it has to be realistic, believable, true to the character, and pertinent to the story. So it's okay to have some friendly, hey, how you doing? But like, you don't have to go through all the stupid bantery type stuff that most people talk about at the coffee shop.
Guttural grunts.
Yeah, you can mention those things on a like, if I see I'm hitting a dead spot with dialogue where maybe two characters have to catch up, maybe they haven't seen each other in a while, instead of me writing 5 pages of, hey, what'd you do last year? Oh, I saw your picture with the kids, and how about that thing on Facebook? You know, I mean, that's, nobody cares, you know? It's not relevant to the story. So I might just use a paragraph and say, and Tom and Dan or whatever sat and had coffee and reminisced about old times, and then da da da, and then they got to the matter at hand, you know, and then the dialogue picks up again. I don't know, something like that. So dialogue is not, in my mind, not filler. It is not meant to, you know, there's very useful things you can do with dialogue, and one of them is the old adage that, or the rule of thumb with good writing is show, don't tell. How people speak, how they react, what they say, that is how you develop your characters. So you think of the writing as drawing out the character instead of me telling you, you know, this guy's a bit somber or cynical, or his dialogue will tell you that. How does he respond to being a question? Is he witty? Is he kind of distant? Is he, you know, so you can use the dialogue, I think, as your number one character tool to paint the picture of what the character is. And you're only going to get that, you know, that's where you have to have a clear picture of a character in your head as you're writing him or her. And the more you interact with people around you in all different types of settings and including, you know, where this, I guess this is like education is really what it is. It's social education. That's where you draw your dialogue from. You're drawing it from your own life experience. I mean, you might see people on TV once in a while that speak a certain way. Like, we know politicians have a certain canned way of speaking, or a newscaster, they all seem to speak in that crazy robotic voice, you know? So you can kind of typecast certain characters in the book that are minor characters. But your key characters, your dialogue is really gonna flesh out who they are.
Yeah.
You know, and how they respond, and what are their values, and how do they respond to other people? Are they engaging? Are they distant? Are they, you know, so.
And that'll make it interesting, and I mean, the kind of literature you like to read, because it's subjective, right? So it's the person's ideas about themselves and other people through that dialogue. I'm just continuing with this idea. Yeah. While you don't want to have that, or at least rarely, the narrator coming from above and telling us what's really going on, and who this person is.
A narrative that just goes on and on and on. When you don't see dialogue in a book, to me it's boring, because the dialogue puts you in the scene as opposed to being told what the scene is.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, that's how I look at it. So I don't think the book should be, you know, a good book should be top heavy in either category. I think it's a good mix of both. But, you know, narrative is sometimes one of those places where you see in more literary works, a lot of description about something that we all know. I mean, you know, if I tell you, you know, the character's walking into a 1950s style you know, house that was built, you know, in a suburban lot, you know, on a cul-de-sac or something. I mean, I don't need to go into every detail about what color the house is and what kind of shutters does it have. Yeah. And the main room has this feature and that
feature.
That's
the problem, you know, with 19th century literature.
Yeah, and literature bores me, quite frankly, in that respect, is that there's too much description. There's not enough action. And literally, you know, and I think that's interesting. That speaks a lot to today's audience in any medium or media, is that, you know, our attention spans have just grown really short, and we want, unless you engage the reader and keep them moving through the process quickly and, you know, and do it in a way with dialogue and short description, I think, you know, that's how you're going to keep them turning the pages.
I'll admit personally, you know, I find myself...
You wander,
I'm
right?
pretty well educated over the years and all that generally, and I read the classics, either took courses where I was forced to and was thankful for it after all, or even volunteer. Nowadays, that I'm approaching 47, I don't have the patience for it anymore.
No.
I really don't. I also suffer from the same generational. Maybe that's why I get along with my kids and my students pretty well. I get it, you know? Well, I wouldn't read it either.
Well, we're a product of our culture, you know? I mean, as consumers of entertainment, we are a product of our surroundings, our culture.
And there's wonderful art today being done, very current, and should be celebrated.
And that's what's nice about art, any type of art or creative work, is that it's always evolving, and there's always going to be opportunities to write different than the last guy or the great masters, because, you know, our environments, the things that we write about, the context of, you know, our society and everything else, it's always changing, always moving forward, so it creates plenty of opportunities. Like we talked about earlier, I'm working on a fourth book that's dealing now with you know, it's a bit of a departure for me, but again, you know, because a lot of my previous three books are more in like that Da Vinci Code meets CSI type genre, where, you know, it's a lot of action and religious history and science and all these things coming together. And then, you know, after the publishing and every other industry on this planet went through some severe problems and consolidations in 2008, 2009 because of the global financial crisis, it really, really just disrupted the publishing industry tremendously. I mean, technology is doing it anyway with you know, all the competition.
I have a song that goes right with that, and we were talking about it yesterday. See if you can guess what it is.
God. This week has
a
been
a song, you said?
14-hour days. I'm tired.
He's got something.
Age of Consent.
Can you hear me?
Okay, Winter Park, welcome back to Punkonomics. And we're having a serious discussion here about spaceships and a bunch of crazy stuff, so let's get back into the conversation here. I think,
since always, you know how it is, we always run out of time. So first of all, you know, hopefully, you know, we were fun enough, and Mike will come back one day, because we also had this whole, like, interesting politics. Politics talk and economics talk, and I think he would fit here very well in our little cell of whatever
lunatics.
We are. Lunatics. And of course, you know, no, it's actually we're the only sane ones because the lunatics have taken over the asylum. We need to play that Fun Boy 3, great song from the
80s.
Oh,
yes,
too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great song.
Well, anyway, as we celebrate.
Is that your pop star pass coming back to?
New Order, 30 years ago, we used to be in clubs and stuff, back when the ships were made of wood and the men of iron, right?
Right.
but in the last minute, so we'll have to seduce him to come back and ask him again. But I'm happy actually because I wanted to make sure we don't go all ranting about how bad the world is and how crazy the economy is and how everybody's playing us and how we don't know what's going on and all that we do regularly, but precisely talk about the literature, which is it's so interesting. And I will be reading your book. So I believe that's my copy that I saw running around.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's out there.
So that's what I'm starting to read today. Lynn Stevenson will wait. The 800-page Mongoliad going on there.
Don't leave it in your bathroom.
Volume 3. I love historical romances when they're done right. But so back to your literature. From description, from a little talk we had. It seems like, in the spirit of the show, in some ways, it's accessible, it's fun, it's entertaining, and smart stuff should be. In fact, I think that is the apex, you know. So I talk in class about The Matrix, you know, a serious critique of capitalism. Homegrown American.
Yeah.
Really? It's an action flick. No. Yes, it's an action flick.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But
yeah.
There's some major, interesting political economy going on there on multiple levels, and maybe even spirituality. My students taught me about the whole Buddhist spiritual side to The Matrix that I didn't really pick up because the left-wing economics kind of hit me in the face
right.
2 minutes into the movie, right?
Yeah.
Because it's my field, right? I'm an economist.
The
third one gets numbrilic, like we say, right?
Right.
It's too much looking at itself.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just... Now, the first one is often the case. Like The Terminator, same thing. You know, action movie, Schwarzenegger, deep movie. So the apex of culture to me, and it has been this case back in ancient times.
Yes, it's okay.
Are you beeped anyway?
Sure, why not?
No.
I think you're being censored.
Jesse just wants to make it like I'm being censored. I haven't. I'm too good for him, so he's trying to make it look like I'm bad, you know?
But somewhere a lawyer is weeping.
I love him for it.
Exactly.
I love him for it. Where was I? Your books are... So I'll jump right to the
Matrix,
point.
Terminator, something else.
Yeah, I'll write... Then I think the apex Shakespeare 2 is badly done. That's the thing. I think on theater, I've watched Shakespeare many, many times. I kind of like Shakespeare, and it's always messed up with very few. The best one I've ever saw was on... I'll give it, you know, this is 80s here. In the time when the Hacienda Club in Manchester and rave culture was...
Right.
Just like one club in the world, just beginning. The good old days. At any rate, in Edinburgh Theatre Festival, in the off fringe of it, in a small room where you get a warning to put plastic on you because the theatrical blood gets to the last seats too, and they had Macbeth, and it was skinheads, but the full original's text.
Wow.
I'm getting goosebumps, right, just talking about it.
That was fine.
That was like Shakespeare wanted it, you know?
Yeah.
The spiral of violence, isn't that what that play is? And they were, these skinheads were scary. But they were talking the original text on perfect. Ah, wonderful. Anyway, as I don't get too nostalgic, you touch on radical stuff in your book.
I do.
Yet it's kind of...
That's what goes on in my brain. So, I mean, you know, it's funny. You got to, like I said, writing is kind of therapy for the writer. So I would like to say I'm writing for the audience and writing a story that I know will be marketable, quote unquote. But the reality is, I mean, you know, I like what I do, and you know, what goes on in my head, I can express it in books through characters and events, and you know, and you can express anger and all sorts of things, and explored through there. So yeah, but I like to think it's a little radical at times.
Because
yeah.
I still need to read it. I can't judge from, you know, reading description, and I will soon. Just like I think I posted about it from a racist double show from last week. I said, at the time I had not yet watched Django Unchained. Well, I have, and yes, it's disgustingly racist and even disgustingly sexist and a very mediocre blaxploitation film, and Tarantino needs to like re-major over himself because you're barely entertaining,
so,
dude.
So the critics were right. The critics I was talking about, they were accurate.
Oh, it got me, you know, like, you know, right. It's the kind of well-meaning racism that sometimes is worse than the outright, you know.
That's a good point.
So you say where the G.I. Joe images may have sparked a problem with them, you know.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, we'll have to have more racism in the media. I mean, when are we need, I don't know, I think we need more than an hour a week, but
I think so too.
I do need sleep though also, so come on, how many jobs do you have to keep a middle class life style these days? But so here's a parallel of a book that really blew me away a little bit, and I think maybe, you know, and I don't want to feel bad because I know in the rock and roll days when people say, oh, you remind me, we kind of often didn't like it. Hunger Games. Okay. Huge success.
Yeah, yeah.
The message in those three wonderful books, which I could not stop. I wasn't sleeping. I read through those three volumes. It's like a radical, revolutionary, rise up, sing the international, get armed, take over.
Yeah. I haven't read the books. That's still on my reading list. I have so many books on my reading list. But
it's great.
But I did see the movie. I thought the movie was good. Actually.
No, but of course, with the usual caveats of a movie where there's a lot of stuff that they can't touch. But I thought it wasn't bad. It wasn't emasculated or, you know, the message wasn't destroyed like sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
But I even asked students that a couple of times. I mean, my God, this is hard lift. Yeah. Or I don't know if really left with populist, maybe, because I think that today in America there's a fake break between the honest conservatives, if you will, or and the honest socialists, and we actually agree about pretty much everything if we just the details, maybe not. But we're marginalized by the mainstream right and left because they fear us.
That book series, though, it's probably a good example of how, you know, even though the story is kind of out there and we would think it's, you know, not very believable in terms of the, you know, the scenarios that they present.
Sure.
It's like a Logan's Run kind of thing, right?
Wow.
In the context of what's going on today around us, I mean, it makes those stories more relevant, though, in a weird, you know, in a strange way, because we can all connect with the ideas, right?
Yeah, science fiction and fantasy absolutely. Are always about society today.
Yeah.
It's not about the
future. Yeah, and like you said, The Matrix and all these things that you write, they have all these subversive tone of, you know, anarchy.
Though this is even, you know, this is like almost it's not a kid's story, obviously. I mean, though I would like to recommend her kid's story, which I also read the entire series, the Gregor the Overlander, which is wonderful for kind of, what do you say, Felix? Young teens to adults, as far as I'm concerned.
I
read
know.
It all.
I could go from like 10 years old
and above. Yeah, and it's also the same because I was so impressed.
They wouldn't get like all the undertones and stuff, but it would still be a good read.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that's like explicitly, you know, people, you know, uprise against the elites, the economic elites, violently, because she explains almost what hard left people will explain, because the elites are the source of the violence.
That's right. Yeah, it's funny. Someday when we have our talk about economics and those issues, you know, there's a guy I respect quite a bit, and you know, I'm sure he's shunned by the industry because he's by the financial analyst industry, because an economist, because of his, but he studies socionomics, Robert Prechter, and he talks about behavioral science. And,
I've heard a couple of.
And
things,
he actually links media and the types of movies that you see to the social mood that then correlates pretty strongly with, you know, the way the economy's, in what direction the economy's moving, and you can kind of, you know, nobody can time markets or anything like that, but you can certainly, I think we'd all agree, you know, at a commonsensical level that behavior drives buying of anything, you know, your confidence in the future or lack thereof will say, how much am I going to consume today? Am I going to be able to pay the bill for it? You know, so, I mean, we'll have to have a discussion about that
one
day.
Because
he really digs deeply into movies and all, and talks about that and says, you know, what types of movies pretend what may happen in the markets and things. It's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I mean, when he looks, you know, backwards and forwards, of course.
But are people making? I mean, missing that sometimes. It's like over the years, I've asked students all the time.
Reflects social mood is the gist of it. You know, the movies will reflect the social mood, and when you see all this violence and shoot 'em up and kind of escapist type movies that are not very thought provoking or plot driven or character. Yeah, I mean, you know, when it's just a lot of explosion. I mean, granted, hey, I enjoy them too. I mean, sure. A lot of CGI. It's entertaining, and that's really what it is when you're there.
So
for
just
those
blowing
two or three
stuff
hours.
Up needs to be done well too. By the way, let's not forget.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. But there's just, you know, I think, you know, you get desensitized to it as when you go into the movies, and I think it needs to be done. You know, it's going to get harder to do it more smartly going forward. Just blowing stuff up isn't enough anymore, right?
Are you referring to Die Hard number 4 or something?
I like Die Hard. I thought it was pretty good.
I think it was the first or second.
Very linear plot, right? Yeah. We knew who the bad guys were. I mean, it was pretty linear. I mean, you know what's going to happen. But it was entertaining. Sure. And see, that's the difference, is that I think, you know, there's so many, you know, ways you can explore your curiosities academically or otherwise or artistically. You know, but when you want to just sit back and kick it back and kind of lose yourself in something. I mean, a lot of times you don't want it to be overly thought provoking or, you know, and that's I think that's the balance for, say, a modern novelist or a filmmaker or anything, is you got to, you know, if there's a marketability factor to anything, it has to recognize the fact that most people, like, you know, I've been playing guitar for a number of years. Now I could sit there and jam solos on my guitar all day long, and then people will start yawning about 2 minutes into it, because unless you're a guitarist, you really don't care about all that noise.
Right.
You want a nice steady rhythm that you can hum along and tap your foot to, and, you know, and I think that the arts in general are like that. The mass market is looking for entertainment.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, I think that but then we feed them white supremacist, I'm looking for the word that would come out of my mouth.
Well, there's subliminals.
Well, I'm not saying I agree with it. I mean, you can understand why it happens.
People like The Matrix, and it's thought-provoking. People like Hunger Game, very thought-provoking. There's a world of wonderful action movies like that. And then there's Battleship that makes the experience of, of playing Hungry Hungry Hippo an intellectual, you know, climax. Etc. Or even Transformers, kind of weak, all that CGI and so little writing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm saying we could be entertaining as well as thought-provoking and as artists, in a sense, you know?
But it dummies, it dummies us all down at some level, right?
You know, cut it down. Okay, we're out of time. People are pushing us off. Bye-bye. We'll be back as soon as we can. Thank you, and I'm definitely going to try and bully Mike here to come back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
See ya.
All right, you've been listening to Punkonomics here on WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. The best in basement radio and the voice of Rollins College. We'll see you next week, same time at 9 o'clock, every Friday.